KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
State Department.
The Trump administration has taken a big step towards its promise to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. The agency will soon be roughly half the size it was just weeks ago. NPR's Janaki Mehta has more.
Nearly every office within the agency will lose staff, though federal student aid and the Office for Civil Rights were hit especially hard. The Office for Civil Rights is responsible for fielding complaints from families whose students face discrimination at school, including students with disabilities. At least 240 staff from the office were laid off, and most were attorneys, including Sharia Smith.
Not only are we concerned about how we will now pay our bills, but what impact this is going to have to the American public.
Smith is also the president of a union that represents Ed Department employees. All union officers in her chapter have been laid off. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
The Agriculture Department is canceling $1 billion of funding for two food programs. The programs pay for meat and produce bought directly from local producers that goes to food banks and schools. More from NPR's Ashley Lopez.
Agency officials said in a statement that they're sunsetting these programs in an effort to save money and create more fiscal responsibility in the federal government. These programs, which were created during the pandemic, made purchasing agreements that helped local farmers and ranchers provide food for school children and people struggling to afford groceries. In a statement, Alexis Bylander with the Food Research and Action Center says these cuts will have, quote, a devastating impact on students, schools, farmers, and local economies. She says these programs are particularly important as food costs continue to rise and schools struggle to stretch their meal budgets. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Stocks recovered somewhat today, fueled by better than expected inflation figures. The S&P was up 27 points. The Nasdaq rose 212 points today. You're listening to NPR. The European Union has announced it will be implementing retaliatory tariffs of 50% on several U.S. products, including bourbon. Bria Jones of Louisville Public Media spoke with a Kentucky economist about it.
The European Union has announced it will double tariffs first put on U.S.-made goods like bourbon during President Donald Trump's first administration. The retaliatory tariffs come in response to U.S. tariffs of 25% on steel and aluminum. Jason Bailey heads the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy.
95% of the world's bourbon is made in Kentucky. In this case, it's going to hurt us, right in the gut.
The EU's 50% tariffs are set to go into effect April 1st. People in the bourbon industry have expressed hopes that negotiations will prevent them from being implemented. For NPR News, I'm Bria Jones in Louisville.
One early victim of price pressures brought on by the Trump administration's tariff fight with other countries may be iRobot, the maker of the popular Roomba vacuum cleaner. Shares of the company plunged today after iRobot issued a statement saying given tariff-related uncertainties and already large losses, the company's future is uncertain. The company's losses in the fourth quarter of last year widened to $77.1 million. The automated vacuum maker says it's having a tough time keeping up with Chinese rivals. Deal by Amazon to acquire the company in 2022 fell apart over antitrust and privacy concerns related to spatial data the vacuums collect. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up $1.43 a barrel to settle at $67.68 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles. The Trump administration continues to fire, shut down, or defund independent elements of the federal government that traditionally work as a check on presidential power. Supporters of President Trump say that's exactly the point. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson and NPR Political Correspondent Susan Davis have been reporting on this effort and how it could change government. They join us now. Hey to both of you.
Hi, Elsa.
Hey there.
Okay, can you just start by explaining first the kinds of actions that you're talking about here? When you say that President Trump is weakening or eliminating parts of the federal government that would ordinarily be a check on the executive. Carrie, you first.
Well, let's start with the Justice Department, my focus, where new leaders have basically swept the top ranks of the civil service. They've fired prosecutors who worked on cases against Donald Trump and against people who stormed the Capitol. They've fired the top ethics officials, the pardon attorney, the person in charge of Freedom of Information Act requests, and they've tried to transfer some of the country's most experienced prosecutors who handle national security and tax issues into an office devoted to immigration. That's one of Trump's top priorities. They've also installed Ed Martin as U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C. He has no prosecutorial experience. He's been posting on social media that he's a lawyer for the president, and he's threatened to go after people who criticize billionaire Elon Musk.
And one of the early actions that I would point to is when Trump decided that he was going to fire independent inspectors general across 18 different federal agencies. And these were jobs that were created in response to the Watergate scandal under President Nixon. They were designed to create more accountability in the executive branch. But there's long been a view on the right that these jobs never should have been created in the first place. One of the people who agrees with that is John Yoo. He's a conservative legal scholar and a former Justice Department official.
And one way to understand what Trump is trying to do, and I'm not saying even that Trump understands this is what he's doing, but the presidency, the way it's designed, urges him to do it, is he's trying to snap those bounds that were imposed on the presidency in the post-Watergate era.
So is the argument from some people on the right essentially there should be no independent checks on the president?
Within the executive branch, yes. I mean, people like you would argue that these agencies should absolutely exist, but they should be more directly accountable to the White House. And you can see Trump testing these boundaries by his administration's effort to shutter the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, for instance, as well as the stop work orders, the firings or attempted firings at independent agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Election Commission.
Okay, that may be the theory of executive power of some people on the right, but what about critics against the Trump administration's actions? Like, how are they characterizing what President Trump is doing here?
From the perspective of some of these outside government watchdogs, Donald Trump is explicitly undermining the forces within the government that are aimed at stopping corruption. I spoke with Danielle Bryan. She leads the Project on Government Oversight.
I don't think it's inconsequential that removing the heads of those offices whose job it is to protect whistleblowers and prevent corruption and wrongdoing were the early targets of the Trump administration. I think what's also important is the signal that that sends to all those who are left behind.
Bryan says no one's going to feel empowered now to raise their hand and report any wrongdoing or a conflict of interest. And the Trump administration is now fighting more than 100 lawsuits over some of these moves. So many it's needed to move lawyers around to defend the government in these cases.
I also spoke with Tara Molloy. She's a lawyer at the Campaign Legal Center, another election watchdog group. And she noted the February 18th executive order calling for the president to have, quote, supervision and control of the entire executive branch. She called that point blank a power grab. Her focus is on the attempt to control the FEC, which oversees campaign finance laws. And look, she made this point that it can't both be a neutral arbiter of campaign laws and report directly to the president, one of the candidates on the ballot.
And I think you can see the basic unfairness if you were to flip the situation. If, for instance, the Biden administration had exerted presidential control over the FEC, would President Trump think that his 2024 campaign was getting a fair shake?
Yeah, but I got to ask, you know, whatever your legal or constitutional theory of executive power is, politically speaking, pushing for extremely expansive executive power seems like a risky endeavor in this country. Americans fought a war so they didn't have to answer to a king. So is there much public support now for essentially a less accountable president?
Look, there's a lot of political contradictions here. I would note that Trump campaigned very loudly on this idea that the president should exert more power over the government, and he won fair and square. So these actions shouldn't really come as a surprise to the country. But you're right, there isn't a ton of evidence that the country is clamoring to have this all-powerful executive.
And in the federal courts, they move pretty slowly, but they're really the only part of the system that's right now working as a check on the executive branch. They've been under pressure, too, from the president, who's been criticizing judges, and from Elon Musk, who's been calling for some of these judges to be impeached. The big question now is how long the courts can withstand that kind of pressure.
Right. Okay. So obviously many court battles ahead on this, but can we just presume for the sake of argument that Trump is successful in bringing some element of these functions directly under the control of the White House? How could that all play out, you think?
We're seeing some of it happen right now. Last year, in the immunity decision about Donald Trump, the Supreme Court gave a president nearly absolute power over the Justice Department, including the ability to have conversations about criminal cases and other enforcement actions. And Trump seems to be taking full advantage of that power right now. It's really been giving rise to a concern that allies of the president are getting a break from the Justice Department, and that some of Trump's critics could be getting targeted by it. The DOJ and the FBI, of course, have a great deal of power to put people under enormous financial and psychological pressure. And if that power is being misused, it will have consequences for the rule of law.
Taken to its extreme, it would usher in an era of little or no independent checks on the president, with fewer or no watchdogs and more politicized agencies. Now, proponents of this would say, look, accountability would still exist. It would exist in the court of public opinion. Presidents are still held accountable in elections by voters, and also in the constitutional checks on power afforded Congress. Congress has the authority to pass laws to rein in the presidency, or the ultimate power of impeachment to remove a president. But Elsa, as we're also living this in real time, public opinion doesn't matter as much in a second term, and Congress, particularly when controlled by the same party, demonstrates little interest in checking their president.
So far, at least. That is NPR's Susan Davis and Carrie Johnson. Thank you to both of you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
New data shows that inflation cooled in February and that gas prices were down. It also showed that the price of groceries held steady, but that egg prices continue to climb at double-digit rates. Today's cost of living report comes just as President Trump is imposing new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. So what does all of this mean for consumers? Well, NPR's Scott Horsley is here to explain. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Juana.
All right, Scott, let's start off with eggs, which, as you know, have become sort of the poster child for rising food costs. What happened last month?
Egg prices jumped by another 10%+ in February. That's on top of the 15%+ increase the month before. avian flu just continues to ravage the chickens around the country that lay eggs, and the resulting shortage has pushed prices sky high. Steve Salas runs a chain of casual restaurants right here in the Washington area. He goes through about 72,000 eggs every week.
We're known as a place that sells breakfast all day. You know, it's not really easy just to change your menu when you have probably about 25 dishes on your menu that sell eggs.
Salas recently started adding a 75-cent surcharge on those egg dishes. Other chains like Waffle House and Denny's have made similar moves. So far, Salas says customers have not balked at the extra expense.
They're very understanding, and you know, people like eggs, and people have been very gracious. This is what the realities are. This has nothing to do with us or anybody else. It's just the circumstances, and if you want eggs, then you'll pay up a little bit more.
Now, eggs did see the biggest price hike on the inflation scoreboard last month, but that was offset by price declines elsewhere in the supermarket, so the overall grocery basket cost the same as it did the month before.
Okay, got it. And I understand inflation overall was a little cooler than it has been?
That's right. The annual inflation rate in February was 2.8%. That's the lowest it's been in 3 months. And that's partly due to the big drop in the price of airline tickets, which is a reflection in part of falling jet fuel prices, but could also signal weaker demand for travel. This week, both Delta and American Airlines said they expect to see some belt tightening this year. And even though it's come down a bit, inflation is still higher than the Federal Reserve would like. So policymakers are expected to hold interest rates steady when they meet next week. If we continue to see progress on inflation like this, though, forecasters think we could be in line for some additional interest rate cuts later in the year.
Let me ask you this. What could interrupt that progress?
Well, one obvious candidate is President Trump's trade war. Today, as you mentioned, the president added a 25% tax on all imported steel and aluminum. That has the potential to raise prices for automobiles and building materials and six packs of beer. Since the beginning of last month, Trump has also added more tariffs on imports from China, including some consumer goods that were exempt from tariffs during the first time Trump was in office. And the president's threatening to add a whole lot more tariffs starting next month. Now, as we have been repeatedly reminded in the last week and change, not every tariff Trump talks about actually goes into effect. But Chief Economist Joe Bruzuelos of RSM says those tariffs that do take effect are likely to push prices higher, especially for big-ticket manufactured items.
I take President Trump both literally and seriously when he talks about trade taxes and tariffs. If we see these taxes put on imports, you'll see it in durables especially.
Of course, other countries don't just roll over and surrender in this trade war. The EU, Canada, China are all pushing back with tariffs of their own on U.S. exports. That could hurt a lot of American farmers and manufacturers. And by the way, some of the corn and soybean farmers whose overseas markets could be hurt by those retaliatory tariffs are also getting pinched here at home by avian flu, which is depressing demand for chicken feed. At the same time, it's driving up egg prices.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From EasyCater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Across federal agencies, the government stores a lot of data on all of us. We're talking about addresses and social security numbers for sure, but also information that could be even more sensitive, like medical diagnoses or whether you've ever filed for bankruptcy. Now, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE, has access to the databases storing all of that data, and it's raising alarm. At least a dozen lawsuits are attempting to stop DOGE from tapping into this personal information. And these lawsuits have focused on one particular legal avenue, a 50-year-old law called the Privacy Act of 1974. With us to talk about that law is Danielle Citrin. She's a law professor at the University of Virginia. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about these lawsuits, can you just take us back to the mid-1970s? How did the Privacy Act of 1974 even come about? Like, what was it designed originally to do?
So it was amidst a time in the late 60s where Congress sort of got wind of the fact that agencies had about 7,000 systems of record, so databases. And they got really interested in it because the National Crime Information Center, so the FBI now we think of as the database that shares criminal information between the states, locals, and the feds, had an incredible amount of sensitive information, including arrests that never went anywhere. And that information was being freely shared with employers, with colleges. So people were losing life opportunities. And, you know, all of this is happening in the backdrop of Watergate, in the backdrop of Hoover's blacklist, which contained files on every single senator and a congressman. There were gathering personal data on each and every one of us that were being shared across agencies without any safeguards. And you know, there was heated agreement across the aisle that we worried that it gave government a lot of power, excessive power, that could control us.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there today who never even knew the Privacy Act of 1974 existed. How relevant has this law been over the last 50 years? Like, how much has it been invoked when there are concerns with how the federal government is handling people's private information?
The Privacy Act was once a quite sleepy law in my privacy classes. It's gotten increasing prominence, in part because there's been so much compliance with the Privacy Act. You know, every agency now has to put out, you know, notices about having new collections of information in databases. And there's chief privacy officers at every agency. You have to pay attention to it and adhere to its commitments, which are to ensure that you don't collect information you shouldn't be collecting for a proper purpose and that you're not sharing it with unless you meet the conditions of the Privacy Act.
Okay, well, then let's talk about these dozen or so lawsuits now that concern access DOGE has had to personal data. Who exactly is filing these lawsuits? Like, what's the argument that the plaintiffs are making here?
Privacy groups and attorneys are representing employees of the government and individuals whose data is collected in these systems of records that are protected by the Privacy Act. And they're arguing that there's real harm here. They're losing their jobs. They're being fired. Presumably, we need to figure out in discovery if the loss of those jobs have to do with being in the databases, but we're pretty sure that's probably true. You need to figure out who the employees are so you can fire them. And asserting that the Privacy Act is sacred and that we honor when you turned over your data and you directly gave it to an agency, that it would only be accessed and used and disclosed pursuant to that reason you gave it to them. Right. And you trusted the government with that information.
Okay, but what is the argument that the Trump administration is making for why they are allowed, members of DOGE are allowed to access this information?
The Trump administration is arguing that the DOGE employees, let's say they're working at the Department of Education, mm-hmm. that they have every right to go into these systems of records to check for fraud, waste, and abuse.
Simply because they are now employees of the Department of Education?
That's right. And it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the Privacy Act that if they worked at the Department of Education, they couldn't get into records that include, you know, personal data unless it was part of their job. Right. And part of the Privacy Act is really specific about conditions on when, for law enforcement purposes, you can disclose information that's protected by the Privacy Act. And it's only when the head of a law enforcement agency makes a written request that's really particularized about what records it wants.
Even if a judge does rule that federal agencies should not be sharing this sensitive data with DOGE, isn't there still the possibility that the Trump administration won't be deterred and will continue to give DOGE access anyway? I'm sorry to even be asking this question right now, but who's to say the Trump administration will care what a judge rules?
Right. I mean, that's the fundamental question on the minds of every law professor, lawyer, and law student, that even if, you know, a court so orders that DOGE employees shouldn't have access to these records and that they should destroy any data that they collected in violation of the Privacy Act, that they may just say, sorry, I'm not going to comply with the court order. And I think at that moment, when that happens, you know, it's really testing our confidence in democracy and the rule of law.
Danielle Citrin is a law professor at the University of Virginia. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Netflix debuts a new talk show tonight, Everybody's Live with John Mulaney. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says it's a program intended to boost the streaming service's live offerings.
For proof of how offhandedly unconventional John Mulaney's new talk show may be, consider the promotional trailer released for the show, featuring footage shot from a distance with Mulaney standing in a parking lot talking to the camera operator.
Let me know when you're tight enough that I should say the line. Is someone going to cue me when... I just want to be tight enough that saying the line makes sense.
Eventually, Mulaney said the show's tagline.
Everybody's Live is on Wednesdays Live.
But the real point was to show something quirky and creative with little attempt to hide the impulsive nature of it all. It's the kind of approach required for a streaming service looking to reinvent both live TV programming and the celebrity talk show format. Mulaney told CBS Sunday Morning that doing the show live had a special appeal.
It's a fun feeling to know that hopefully a lot of people are watching, and it's live globally with no delay, and you could really damage your career.
His current show was inspired by a live Emmy-winning program he presented on Netflix last year called Everybody's in L.A. The series, which aired over 6 days, was praised by critics, including myself, for shaking up the typical formula with an anti-talk show approach, featuring unexpected guests and incisive jokes about Los Angeles.
The first person to ever move to Los Angeles was a Spanish explorer in 1781 who thought he'd give it a shot here after friends told him he was the funniest guy at work.
Everybody's Live is expected to follow a similar path, with tonight's guests ranging from actor Michael Keaton to personal finance columnist Jessica Roy. The series airs on Netflix for 12 consecutive Wednesdays, starting at 10 p.m. Eastern. Eric Deggans, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
5 years ago this week, COVID-19 was declared a pandemic. Now, while it revealed problems in how health authorities respond to infectious disease outbreaks,
they've made huge improvements in their ability to see what's happening here in the United States.
In some big ways, pandemic preparedness has also gotten worse. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Kansas just joined the growing list of states that ban or limit gender-affirming medical care for teens.
Some of the nation's biggest religious groups cheered the move. Other faith leaders did not.
As I read the literature of this bill, I see in it something that is terribly unkind.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Russia says it wants to hear more details about a U.S. negotiated 30-day ceasefire proposal for Ukraine. Kyiv signed onto the deal this week following marathon talks between U.S. and Ukrainian officials in Saudi Arabia. NPR's Charles Maines has more.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow was studying public statements out of the U.S.-Ukrainian talks, which restored American military support for Kyiv in exchange for the ceasefire offer. But Peskov warned Moscow wouldn't weigh in until it had detailed information from the American negotiators, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and White House envoy Mike Waltz. A U.S. delegation is anticipated in Moscow in the coming days. President Trump has also said he expects to discuss the ceasefire proposal in a call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, more nationalist voices in Russia have condemned the offer as a diplomatic bid by Ukraine to stave off recent Russian gains on the battlefield. Charles Maines, NPR News.
New Hampshire Democratic Senator Jeanine Shaheen has decided she won't seek a fourth term next year, NPR's Deidre Walsh reports.
Shaheen, who is 78, is the first woman in the U.S. to be elected both governor and senator. She says her commitment to public service won't change.
But today, after careful consideration, I'm announcing that I have made the difficult decision not to seek re-election to the Senate in 2026. It's just time.
Democrats need to pick up four seats to regain control of the Senate, but Shaheen's announcement could make that challenging. She is the third Democrat from a competitive state opting not to run again. The Senate Republican Campaign Committee predicted the Granite State would elect a common-sense Republican in 2026. But the race to replace Shaheen is expected to be closely contested by Democrats. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is NPR. The UN says children in one of the world's largest refugee camps are experiencing the worst levels of malnutrition in nearly 8 years, due in part to military attacks. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
UNICEF says in a statement that child malnutrition is surging in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar, home to some 500,000 ethnic Rohingya. Many fled or were forced to flee their homeland in neighboring Myanmar nearly 8 years ago following military attacks. Multiple crises are causing Rohingya children to go hungry, chief among them shortfalls in international aid amid the Trump administration's suspension of USAID. UNICEF says without that money, schools will be shut down and waterborne diseases will surge, and they'll have to cut food rations in half to just $6 a month. UNICEF officials say that's not enough for a person to survive. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Asagao.
Some major U.S. trading partners swiftly retaliated today against President Trump's 25% tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Canada, the largest supplier of steel and aluminum to the U.S., hit back with its own 25% tariffs on U.S. products, including beef and bourbon, while the European Union also raised tariffs on American-made motorcycles, peanut butter, and jeans, among other things. The EU says prices will go up in both countries, risking jobs. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here's what we know. Ukraine has agreed to a 30-day ceasefire in its war with Russia. This would mark the first such pause after more than 3 years of full-scale fighting. Now, what we don't yet know is how Russia may respond to the proposal, which is being brokered by the Trump administration. For more, we are joined by NPR's Greg Myrie, who has covered the war extensively. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Okay, so I want to start with Russia's perspective, since we're waiting on their response here. What are the pros and cons from Russia's point of view of this one-month ceasefire?
Well, the downside is that Russia has been advancing on the battlefield, and this could halt its momentum if the fighting suddenly stops and gives Ukraine some time to regroup. So far, the Kremlin has said only that it's studying the proposal. There's no real sign, though, of enthusiasm for it. And Russian military bloggers, they only speak for themselves, but they have these huge followings, and they tend to reflect the mood of the national security establishment. Mm-hmm. Many are calling the ceasefire a trap and say it should be rejected by Russia.
Okay, that would seem to be the downside. What's the possible upside for Russia?
Well, the Russians have been very pleased with comments by President Trump in recent weeks, saying his worldview seems to align largely with Russia's. So even if Russian leader Vladimir Putin doesn't like the ceasefire, he may be looking at the bigger picture, at the long game, and doesn't want to risk antagonizing Trump by rejecting the truce. I spoke about this with Dmitry Alperovich, a prominent commentator on the war who runs the Washington think tank, the Silverado Policy Accelerator.
Putin is in a little bit of a bind. I think it will be hard for him to reject this outright because he doesn't want to get Trump to be mad at him and to start cracking down even further. So I think he'll try to weaken it. I think a permanent deal is still unlikely, but he may have to accept a 30-day ceasefire.
Greg Myrie, the backdrop, of course, is it was, what, less than 2 weeks ago that we had that dramatic confrontation in the White House between President Trump, Vice President Vance, and Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. Are we seeing now maybe the pendulum swinging a little bit the other way, ramping up pressure on Russia?
Yeah, possibly. One certainty about Trump is that he's unpredictable. His recent remarks on Russia prompted all this commentary that decades of U.S. foreign policy were being reversed now with a sympathetic view toward Russia. Yet the past couple days have looked more familiar. The U.S. says in Ukraine say they're in sync on the ceasefire plan. Zelensky called it positive. Trump said just today that the next move is up to Russia. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said he hoped a truce could start within days. And if Russia said no, that would be highly unfortunate. So what's next? Well, here's Alperovich again.
There's nothing permanent about the current situation. The relationship with Ukraine may still deteriorate. The relationship with Russia can be on the upswing once again, or it can go back. So the unpredictability of this administration is something that unnerves both allies and enemies alike.
Greg, I want to close with a big picture question. If we get a one-month ceasefire, if Russia agrees, chances that that would lead to a broader agreement, an actual end to this war?
Mary Louise, that's still a long way off. Both sides have said previously they aren't really interested in temporary ceasefires. They want lasting agreements, but their aims are fundamentally at odds. Ukraine wants security guarantees from the West so it won't be attacked by Russia again. But the Trump administration says that's a job for Europe, not the U.S. Mm-hmm. Russia wants to keep nearly 20% of Ukraine that it's captured and the rest to be a buffer zone. There's no clear way to bridge these divides.
And Pierre's Greg Myrie, thanks.
Sure thing, Mary Louise.
In a big shakeup of Greenland's political landscape, a pro-business opposition party is the surprise winner in the island's election. The party favors a slow approach to gaining independence in a campaign stoked by President Trump's pledges to gain control of the island in Copenhagen. Adrian Murray has more.
Celebrations into the early hours. A landslide victory for Greenland's Democrats.
The centre-right party swept up almost 30% of the vote, promising to grow the economy first before taking a slow, steady path to more autonomy. A result few expected. Noah Reddington is a political analyst.
This was an avalanche, really, and completely unpredictable. But it's a huge blow for the ruling coalition right now. It's a major upset of Greenlandic politics.
Doubling its vote share, the Nalliraq party also had a strong showing. It wants a swift divorce with Denmark and closer ties with Washington. Domestic issues have also played a big factor. Both parties in the coalition government had a bruising election, hit hard by an unpopular fishing policy. Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory of Denmark and mostly governs its own domestic affairs. However, Copenhagen, some 1,800 miles away, controls foreign and defence policy and sends over $600 million in assistance every year. The atmosphere was almost festive as polling stations in the capital Nuuk opened, drawing long lines of voters for an election seen as one of the most pivotal for the Arctic Territory's future. Five of the six parties on the ballot had favoured breaking away from Denmark, but offered different paths and speeds. Voters backed the slower path. Mira Kleist is a political advisor.
They want a stable path. They don't want anything radical. They want the population to be able to feel secure and know that it will be a steady path under strong leadership. There will be no quick referendum.
At an event in Copenhagen late Tuesday night, a group of local Greenlandic people had come together to watch the election results roll in. For Stina Hansen Kleist, independence was a big talking point.
Of course, I want to see that in my lifetime. But I also know that we're not entirely there yet. We have to get a lot of stuff in place before we can talk about independence. And with this election, there's been so many talks about going independent now to work more with America. Oh, we're not ready there yet. That's how I feel.
Greenland has been thrust into the global spotlight by Donald Trump's threats to take it. Greenlander Margrethe Johansson shared her thoughts.
Yeah, I think a lot of people got scared also. Actually, I also got scared. But when we start thinking and see what's happening here, actually the Greenlandic population is quite pragmatic.
Experts say independence could take years to achieve, so it's unlikely to happen before Donald Trump's second term comes to an end. Never before has a Greenlandic election been watched so closely from Denmark. Noah Reddington thinks this marks a turning point.
Everyone is surprised, really, and we need to rethink our relationship between Denmark and Greenland and the whole construction of the Kingdom of Denmark with Greenland, the Faroe Island, and Denmark. It's a construction that definitely is going to change in the years to come.
Though the Democrats have won the most votes, they're still short of the seats needed for a majority in Parliament and will now enter talks with the other parties to form a new government, facing a new geopolitical challenge from Washington. For NPR News, I'm Adrienne Murray in Copenhagen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. What do Harvard, Notre Dame, and the University of Washington have in common? Answer, they are among the many universities that have recently announced hiring freezes because of uncertainties around federal funding. As NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, those pullbacks could have ripple effects far beyond college campuses.
More than a dozen institutions of higher education have said in recent weeks that they will be pausing the hiring of new faculty and staff. It's a move that both private and public universities are making across the country, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to UC San Diego. They all cite the same reason: changing federal policies that put their finances in doubt.
What are the different pots of resources that provide support for colleges and universities?
That's Derek Anderson, a senior vice president at the American Council on Education.
The big one is state and local funds, and then the second one is tuition revenues, and then the third would be federal support, whether that's through federal student aid or through other federal programs.
The Trump administration has moved to pull some of that support. It's shrinking the Department of Education, whose responsibilities include managing college financial aid and federal student loans. It's also threatened to pull funding from schools that don't follow its guidance about eliminating diversity initiatives and fighting anti-Semitism.
We are clearly in a world where the administration has an agenda for higher education, and universities have a long history of being partners with every administration in advancing the nation's interest.
So what are universities supposed to do? Anderson says a hiring freeze is a logical first step.
A hiring freeze allows these universities to sort of like recalibrate where they need to start putting their emphasis.
Some are also taking steps like pausing travel and shrinking budgets while they wait for the picture of federal support to become clearer. One example is the Trump administration's move to limit how much funding the National Institutes of Health can give to universities. That move is blocked while legal cases play out, but could cost schools millions of dollars.
We have tens of thousands of people who are dedicating their lives to this work. And if they can't pay the bills, then we're going to have cascading economic consequences.
The lack of funding will hurt current and prospective students and faculty, Anderson says. It would also be felt by local economies and college towns, people across the country who depend on medical research, and ultimately on the world stage.
If we lose pace in our development of scientific human capital, then we start to run the risk of being less competitive globally. There are countries like China and Russia who are doing anything possible to take away from American scientific competitiveness.
He hopes there's still consensus that higher education is a worthwhile investment, even if its future looks unclear for now. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
For years, actor Amanda Seyfried played bubbly characters in hit films like Mamma Mia and Mean Girls. In her latest role, she plays a cop fighting the opioid epidemic in Philadelphia.
It was one of those really impossible goals for me because I was the ingenue for a long time, and I just never saw myself as someone who could even pretend to have authority.
Find out how she made the jump tomorrow on All Things Considered. You can tune in online, on the radio, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
on a Wednesday. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last month, Kansas became the 26th state to ban or otherwise limit gender-affirming medical care for teens, according to KFF. Those bans are supported by some of the biggest religious groups in the U.S., including the Catholic Church and the Southern Baptist Convention. But as Rose Conlin of member station KMUW reports, not all faith leaders agree.
In the small Kansas town of Winfield, worshipers gather for Sunday service at Grace United Methodist Church. Pastor Charles McKenzie begins his sermon by introducing himself and his pronouns, he, him.
Gracious God, may the words that are coming out of my mouth and the meditations that are shared by all of our hearts gathered here.
McKenzie is a lifelong Republican and was raised in a church that taught homosexuality and gender diversity are counter to Christian teachings. But McKenzie says he came to believe that all humans are made in the image of God, a belief that has become personal for him.
Just as there is a spectrum of light and dark, because we have sunrises and sunsets, in the same way, I think that God's creation is broad enough and beautiful enough and wide enough to include variations of what we have understood as a gender binary.
He recently traveled to Topeka to testify against legislation that bans gender-affirming medical care for trans teenagers. In a packed legislative committee room, Bible in hand, he rose and read from the book of Micah.
What does the Lord require you, human, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly? And as I read the literature of this bill, I see in it something that is terribly unkind.
Other faith leaders are speaking out, too. The Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism condemned recent executive orders by the Trump administration, limiting the federal recognition of gender to male and female, and banning transgender soldiers from military service. The center's director, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, says the Torah emphasizes compassion for people different from you.
The biblical text repeats 36 different times in 36 different ways. Because you were enslaved in Egypt as strangers, you should love the stranger.
Pesner says that love means allowing people to get the medical care they determine that they need. But other religious leaders come to very different conclusions. The Vatican says gender-affirming care violates human dignity, and the Kansas Catholic Conference lobbied for the state's ban. The Southern Baptist Convention also opposes the care. Miles Mullen is vice president of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He says love does not always mean affirmation.
True love and compassion has to start with the reality of a situation. And it's not truly loving or compassionate to help people live out a delusion.
Mullen says Christians have a duty to advocate against allowing minors to receive medical care that they believe will cause lasting harm.
It's appropriate for believers to say that the state has a role to play in protecting vulnerable people. We see this as the proper role of the state in Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2.
The religious divides on transgender rights are reflected in new polling by the Public Religion Research Institute. The group found that a majority of Unitarians, Jewish Americans, Hindus, Buddhists, and the religiously unaffiliated oppose bans on gender-affirming care for minors. Catholics and mainline Protestants across races are relatively evenly divided on the issue, while a majority of Muslims, white evangelical Protestants, and Latter-day Saints support the bans. Back at Grace United Methodist Church, McKenzie's office is decorated with rainbow flags. Like many Americans, his perspective on gender identity is shaped by his personal relationships. In his case, being the dad of a gender-fluid teenager.
The experience of parenthood should lean us towards empathy. My children have, in many ways, made me a much better version of who I am than I would have been without them.
His child, Cambria, is 17 and uses they-them pronouns. They're grateful for faith leaders like their dad, who stick up for the queer community.
I can look at him and I can know that there is somebody with a voice, somebody who is the epitome of what people will listen to, who is out there standing for me and for others.
Cambria says as political debates over trans rights continue, having an accepting church community makes a world of difference. For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Winfield, Kansas.
Ontario, Canada, threatened to hike prices on electricity exported to the U.S. this week, just before President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs were set to take effect. The threat would have boosted Americans' power bills. Now, ultimately, it did not pan out, but the episode did highlight U.S. reliance on imported Canadian power. NPR's Joe Hernandez explains why some American states buy electricity from their northern neighbor.
A few days ago, Ontario Premier Doug Ford said he would slap a 25% surcharge on electricity exported from the province to Michigan, New York, and Minnesota.
If necessary, if the United States escalates, I will not hesitate to shut the electricity off completely.
It prompted President Trump to say he would double the coming tariffs on Canadian aluminum and steel. Ultimately, the two sides backed down from their threats, but it brought to light the long-standing arrangement between the U.S. and Canada, which have an interconnected power system and have traded electricity with each other for decades.
You have cities and urban areas that are close neighbors, and you have electric systems that are close neighbors. There's a sort of imaginary line that runs between them called the border.
Cy McGady is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says large integrated power systems like the one the two countries share are more resilient and cheaper for consumers.
So there's like a basic economic factor that drives grid integration everywhere.
In 2023, the U.S. spent over $3 billion on electricity from Canada, the majority of which comes from the country's hydroelectric plants. The U.S. also sold Canada about $1 billion worth of electricity. Certain parts of the U.S. are more likely to buy Canadian power, such as New York, as well as states in New England, the Midwest, and the Pacific Northwest. If power sales between the U.S. and Canada are disrupted, experts say it'll be consumers who see the charges. Asa McKercher is a professor of U.S.-Canada relations at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia.
And that's what makes this tariff war really self-defeating for both countries, is the fact that we benefited from access to cheap energy.
Ford is set to meet with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick this week, but for now, Ontario electricity costs will remain at their current rate. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/.
Hush now. Explain, choir, don't explain, you mix with Sunday, skip that, lipstick, don't explain.